Moving right along, I'd like to introduce our next speaker, Dean Chaim Hirsch. Chaim joined Cornell this past July as the Dean of the Faculty of Computing and Information Science and a Professor of Computer Science and Information Science, a college-level unit established in 1999 with the mission of integrating computing and information science, its ideas, technologies, and modes of thought into every academic field. He succeeds Dan Huttenlocher, currently the Dean and Vice Provost of Cornell Tech. Prior to coming to Ithaca, Dean Hirsch spent 24 years on the computer science faculty at Rutgers University, serving as the department chair in 2003 to 06, and again in 2012 and 13. From 2006 to 2010, he served as the director of the Division of Information and Intelligent Systems at the National Science Foundation, and he has held visiting or consulting appointments at AT&T Labs, Bar-Ilan University, Carnegie Mellon University, MIT, and the University of Zurich. He received his BS from the Mathematics and Computer Science departments at UCLA, and an MS and PhD in Computer Science from Stanford University. His research has focused on foundations and applications of machine learning, data mining, information retrieval, artificial intelligence, especially targeting questions that integrally involve both people and computing. Most recently, these interests have turned to crowdsourcing, human computation, and collective intelligence. Remember to submit any questions for Chaim using CSV14 and texting that to 22333. Please join me in welcoming Chaim to the podium.
John? So hi, everyone. I'm a Stanford alum, as you heard, and so it's always fun to be back here. My Cornell affiliation, actually, as you heard, is new, and my prior experience with Cornell was about the New York City Tech Campus, where I was rooting for Stanford to win, and suddenly Cornell steals it, and next thing I know, I'm inside the candy store rather than outside looking in. So my talk today is about the future of intelligence, and I realized we needed to come up with these short, pithy titles. Just to be clear, this is not intelligence as in the Edward Snowden type. It's about the intelligence that we exhibit, the thing that's in our head giving rise to the robust behavior that we exhibit. And what's cool is we now are gaining a much better understanding of human intelligence because we're now in the computer era. And so my talk is gonna have two sides to it. One is understanding human intelligence in computational terms. And the flip side is gaining insight into the nature of intelligence through the building and engineering of systems that exhibit the kinds of robust behaviors that we do. Or for those of you who are Star Trek fans, how can we build data? So 1930s or so, the modern computer era kind of started. People were coming up with the idea of computation and computing. 1940s, first computers being built. And some of the very thoughtful people of that era were looking ahead to say, okay, we have these machines. How can we build machines that exhibit the robust behaviors that people do? And that gave rise to the field of artificial intelligence. Build a machine that does everything we do. That's really hard. So the people in the field at that point made a strategic decision to focus on different cognitive skills that we exhibit in our everyday lives. We see, we use language, we manipulate objects and exist in the physical world, we play, we learn, and it gave rise to a number of subfields of artificial intelligence that exist to this day, computer vision, language understanding, and so on. So go into the 60s, into the 70s, and gee, those were pretty hard. How do I build a machine that can see or that can use language? And we carved out more narrow questions to work on, and these are some of the examples in each of those areas. Can I build a machine that recognizes scenes, or that can retrieve a document based on some query you give, or that can drive a car autonomously through the streets of Mountain View? They didn't articulate that the streets of Mountain View at the time, but as we know, that's now a solved problem. Play chess, classify objects into categories. And what's kind of cool, we're at a point right now where artificial intelligence is seeing many successes, and many of you are actually on the pulse of some of these changes. As I go through the different areas, I'm going to exhibit examples of where some of those successes are, and document retrieval is the first I'm going to touch on. And this is a paper from 1965 by Jerry Salton and Michael Lesk. Jerry, shortly after the publication of this paper, when he was at Harvard, moved to Cornell and helped found the computer science department. Michael Less, just as an aside, ended up at Rutgers and was my colleague there. And what they did is they built a system that was able to take queries like give algorithms useful for the numerical solution of ordinary differential equation, you know, et cetera. They were using a database of documents in that area, and they formed the basis of what later became the core of search engine technologies. And so Jerry Salton, co-founder of the computer science department, is one of the brains behind where we are today in search engines. If you want to know where it's going, at 6 o'clock today, Amit Singhal, one of Jerry Salton's last students, is the director of search at Google, and you can hear where those ideas have been taken over the last few decades. So that's in the language area, many successes. Playing games. In 1997, Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov, a computer beat the world chess champion in a full match for the first time. Something that Herbert Simon said would take 10 years in 1957, it finally happened 40 years later, but it happened. Late 90s, in the area of machine learning, there are many examples of successes at machine learning. Here's one where you want to take handwritten text and be able to convert the handwritten text into letters. And by the late 90s, the US Postal Service was using this routinely, and now over 95% of all letters are done through the results of machine learning. This is the car that Sebastian Thrun and his team at Stanford built that won the 2005 DARPA Grand Challenge. And as you may be aware, that's now something that he continued at Stanford and into Google and gave rise to the Google cars that we actually just saw one earlier today driving here. Computer vision, there's many examples. Even simply having your camera autofocus on faces was something that was this grand challenge when I was a grad student in the 80s, and by 2001, we were getting real-time face detection. What I want to do, oops, someone started the video before I explained. The background on this, sorry, it was supposed to start a moment later than it did. Imagine you download all the Flickr images of thousands of tourist sites around the world. Now what you do is you take a bunch of other photos that tourists have taken. You want to say, where were these photos taken? The endpoint of this research agenda that Noah Snavely, Dan Huttenlocher, and their students are pursuing is imagine you download photos of all over the world. And as new photos come along, you automatically figure out where they belong, kind of like the way the World Wide Web is automatically indexed. The reason we're able to do this is because our understanding of how to do computer vision has advanced to the point where you take a bunch of Flickr images of some artifact and you can reconstruct the three-dimensional structure of it. So the reasons for these successes are threefold. One is the advance of science. We're getting smarter and smarter. One of the cool things that's happened in AI is that appearing across all these areas has become we've increasingly appreciated the role of probability and statistical modeling across these areas. These were separate areas, each in their own little silos, and when they started peeking across silos, it turned out that they were using very similar methods, and we now have a core foundation that's enabled effective AI outcomes in many different sectors. Moore's Law, computer speeds are getting faster and faster. And as one example, in 1997, the chess match that Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov in, 1997, it was essentially more or less implementing an idea that Claude Shannon published in 1950. And so it took 47 years for that to eventually happen, with some additional knowledge. But the final thing is data, machine learning, data. So if I want to understand language, there's enormous amounts of textual information available to us on the web and elsewhere. If I want to understand how to build systems that can see, there's lots of examples of images and videos on the internet and elsewhere. And those sources of data have allowed us to, instead of saying, how do I build a system from first principles that understands language, let me just build machines that can learn from data. And so the area of machine learning was originally trying to build systems that replicated one element of cognitive behavior, namely the fact that we can learn. But as a side effect, as a collateral success, if you will, what machine learning has done is it's generated methods that are now core to data mining and other areas where if you get lots of data, we're able to use machine learning and build systems from data rather than doing it from scratch ourselves. So this is where we are today. Common methods and the role of machine learning across all these areas. So where are we going? Well, now that we've gotten these successes, people are getting back in touch with the original goals of AI. How do I build systems with the broad capabilities that people exhibit? So as one example, and there are many examples where people are now trying to find the cross-cutting ideas that can bring different areas of cognitive behavior together, this is the work of Ashutosh Saxena on our faculty in the computer science department. Can you start the video? Turn on volume.
Take some coffee in a cup, add ice cream of your choice. Finally, add raspberry syrup to the mixture.
So it was hard to hear, but he was giving a recipe to make take some coffee, add ice cream, put some raspberry syrup on it. And the robot was able to understand what the student, in this case, said, and was able to assemble the all the different elements of this without ever having done this specific thing before. And so what's implicit, yeah. So there's obvious things here like language understanding and robotics, but this one,
thank you.
What Sharad tries, Ashutosh tries to do is he tries to build systems that learn from human behavior. So for example, the motions that the robot is doing is in part trained by humans to not, for example, swing an ice cream scoop around and hit a person or potentially drip on a person. They did examples with knives that I'm not showing a video for. It's so that's true. I mean, go on YouTube and you can do a search for Ashutosh Saxena and see some videos where there's a big red button, stop, and then they manipulate the hand and show it what it should have done to do it correctly. So machine learning, language understanding, and also bringing ideas from social psychology into the mix as well. Also learning to predict what people might do so you don't do something where the person's about to do, or place the plate where you anticipate the person is going to be. And all of these things are coming together in Ashutosh's work. So another example, another thing that came up in our pursuit of AI is as we gain these successes, people began to realize that those early thinkers in AI, largely, but not entirely, underappreciated the importance of social cognition. So from our infancy, we learned turn-taking through Goo Goo Gaga type play before we even learned to speak or to walk. And it became apparent that some of the limits to what we're able to do were because we hadn't done enough work in understanding how we think about others and how we interact in the real world with people. And so increasingly, this has become an area of AI. And I'll give you two examples, again, coming out of Cornell. One of them is work by Claire Carty, Jeff Hancock, and Mile Ott. So imagine you're a hotel on TripAdvisor, and I want people to come to my hotel, so I plant a bunch of fake positive reviews of my hotel, and you're across the street, and I plant a bunch of negative reviews of your hotel. How do you detect those false reviews? Well, they did it using a combination of machine learning, language understanding, and knowledge from social psychology, which is the area that Jeff Hancock is in. And if you want to know more about how social psychology and the interplay of that, those ideas in technology, check out Jeff's talk at 4 o'clock today. And the other is an example by Lillian Lee and John Kleinberg and their students. And what they were able to show is they're able to infer power differences in individuals based on their footprint in social interactions just in online media. So you can imagine studying a blog and being able to figure out the power differences. So now machine learning and language understanding is giving a tool for people who study the social psychology of people in online settings to be able to advance our understanding of the social psychology and how it pertains to computing. So I focused largely on the AI side of things. And in the time allotted, I'm not going to go into our increased understanding of human intelligence through understanding neuroscience and how it interplays with technology, but I'm going to touch on it a little bit. So understanding human intelligence in computational terms. And the way I'm going to do this is I'm going to relate it to the original scholars who started studying AI in the 1950s. And they fell into two camps, which you might call biomorphic, trying to do things the way people do, and non-biomorphic. Who cares? Airplanes don't flap their wings the way birds do. Why should we make people do it, make machines be intelligent the way people do? And two faces, if you want to put behind this, are Jerry Salton, whose approach to doing document retrieval wasn't about in-depth understanding of human language, but rather counting words in documents. And on this side, we have Frank Rosenblatt, who in 1957 invented the idea of a perceptron, which is the originator of the entire neural network community. There are a number of other key ideas, but he's largely the originator of the neural network research area, where the goal was to build computational systems that behave the way neurons do in the brain. And what we're finding is the two of them are now coming together. We're building systems that exhibit both forms of AI exploration. What's also cool is some of the work in the non-biomorphic side is giving us ideas for things to look on in the biomorphic side. What's going on in the brain? Trying to understand how things are represented based on how we had to represent them in order to get success in the computer sector. So looking ahead, what are things going to look like? Well, we're going to have broadly available AI and natural intelligence, us. What is that going to look like? People are pursuing ideas where AI is amplifying our existing capabilities, augmenting them in new ways, and ultimately, if these are data of the robot, our partners and collaborators, and we're trying to figure out how to do that right. So data of the robot is one image of the future that science fiction has given us. If you're a Star Trek fan, you also know the Borg, which is a more dystopian view of what technology might give us. And what's you're going to see in the future is people are more and more aware that the successes are forcing us to confront questions about the ethical elements of our technology. And what's happening is instead of letting movies like The Terminator define it for people and feed their worst fears, it's important that people in AI are actually telling the story. There's good, there's bad, but what's important is that the people who are informed actually tell you what the story is. And aside from good or bad, what's happening is some people are ignoring these grand visionaries who are predicting utopian or dystopian futures, and they're just getting down to brass bolts and doing things, like Carla Gomes at Cornell, who brought people together in AI and related areas to solve problems in sustainability and environment. And so Carla, who's jointly in computer science and information science, is largely the person who's created this area of computational sustainability over the last decade. So finally, whatever happens with AI, it also has this amazing track record of creating what I call collateral successes. Going back to the 1950s and 1960s, time sharing, functional programming, some might argue object-oriented programming, search engines, recommender systems, Amazon saying maybe this is something you're going to want, are all results that came out of machine learning or other areas of AI, just as things we needed to do in order to enable our successes in AI. So, hopefully I've given you an idea both about where AI is going, where we are, and also that Cornell has played and is going to continue to play an important role in that future. Thank you.
Thank you, Haim. We have a few minutes for questions. Please text in anything that you'd like to potentially present as time allows. First question, what AI research coming out of Cornell are you most excited about?
The answer to that, I often say I'm wearing two hats. One is my dean hat and my other is my scholar hat. And as a scholar, I've become really excited about the interplay between social psychology and the systems that we build, trying to understand people. And actually, I think increasingly people here are aware of this. So like Lars Backstrom is the person behind the Facebook, the thing that orders the information you get. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on it. What the newsfeed? Thank you. And so Facebook knows all about your social network, and also about what are the things that you're liking and disliking, and it's bringing together ideas for social psychology together with machine learning and language understanding as well. So I think the example with Carla and Jeff is an example of where that interplay is happening. So anything that's trying to say, let's not build our machines from scratch, but let's embody that knowledge that we know from social psychology into our systems is so, but I gave you one example that I'm particularly excited about.
Well, here's a good one that will be tough to fit an answer into the time allowed. What are your personal thoughts on what is perhaps the unavoidable path towards human and machine hybrids? Many of the things you were talking about sort of lead you in that direction.
I mean, I wear glasses. It allows me to see things that I wouldn't be able to see otherwise. So Google Glass, there's other technologies that are amplifying our ability to do things. So you want my personal thoughts. I think, first, I love it. I mean, if I can externalize stuff that I do now, like trying to remember things like newsfeed, that would be helpful. Have something that reminds me when I'm stuck in the middle. That would be an example of a human and machine hybrid. I do think there's important questions about on the ethical dimension. I think there's really exciting things that come out of the people who are studying the singularity, where idea that Werner Vinge and John von Neumann and others have kind of suggested may end up happening, where we create intelligence that is so far above human intelligence that we get explosive hyper-exponential growth and leave humans behind. It's good that people are thinking about different ways the future could go. But personally, I hope we have a long enough future with the environment and stuff like this. So I'm excited about it. I think it will also help. One of the things I'm particularly excited about is assistive technologies, people who may not have the capacity to do all the things that someone without physical limitations might have, or mental limitations. So I think that's actually a place where, for example, bringing people into the workforce that weren't in the workforce or keeping people in the workforce longer.
So here's a couple of questions that are sort of tied together. What do you think AI will be capable of accomplishing over the next 10 years? What sort of significant achievement? And related to that, perhaps, what's the biggest roadblock or what's the greatest impediment to further progress in this field?
I don't know what I'm going to have for dinner tonight, much less what's going to happen in 10 years. And the history of computing is filled with people making predictions. One example I like to give is VisiCalc. How many people remember VisiCalc? Great. So Apple personal computer, the personal computer revolution would have happened whenever it happened, but VisiCalc was this major driver of people to buy Apple II computers. Who predicted this concept of a spreadsheet? But that was one of the big drivers of the original adoption of that platform. I will make predictions. Robots in the consumer sector, the aging populace and our inability to serve everyone who we're going to need to serve as healthcare continues to make us live longer and longer. So we already have personal robots, Roomba and other things like this. So as they get smarter and smarter, they'll help us around the house. In the manufacturing sector, greater smarts coming from our understanding of how to build AI systems, so it's not simply rote mechanics. Major roadblocks.
Funding?
Yeah, you see Google buying all these robotics companies. There are a lot of people out there doing things that are anticipating a future where we're going to have intelligent robots in our midst. Google was building their own through the car, but also by buying companies like this. I think language technology is going to be amazingly successful. We're already, you talk to Siri on the phone, or a lot of the times I talk into my phone rather than actually type things. So that future, I think, is less than 10 years away, where robust language interaction will be the norm.
Great.
Let me do it.
I think we have consumed our time limit. Let's thank Chaim for sharing his thoughts with us.
Thank you all.